Now, to continue our small series on the state of modern democracy, and many thanks for the feedback, by the way, on our previous interviews, this morning a related angle, dictatorships, which are suddenly, and perhaps surprisingly at this stage of global human development, on the rise. You might quibble with the definition, but from Putin, to Erdogan in Turkey, to Orban in Hungary, we're seeing autocratic leadership by individuals rather than by healthy democratic institutions. I think that's how my next guest sees it anyway, and she typifies a strand of emerging international research. Natasha Esro is a senior lecturer of government at the University of Essex in England and the co-author of two books on dictatorships. I spoke to her earlier this week.
Thank you.
Maybe I could ask you for your definition of a dictator, and how many of our current leaders would you put in that category?
Well, of a dictator, it's just any leader that refuses to give up power. So when we look at just around the world, whether or not a country is an authoritarian regime or not, we just try to look at whether or not there's been any kind of turnover in power of the executive. Now, if you get into more specifics about what is actually a dictator, just that one person holding on to power, then we're looking at the longevity of that particular person and whether or not they're not willing to step down or not.
Okay, and so the difference between a dictatorship and an autocracy, is there one?
Well, a dictatorship would be like a type of authoritarian regime, if you want to get into real specifics. And so what I think you were referring to in the beginning was these personalist dictatorships. And that is a dictatorship where one person holds all the power. And so they probably weaken the military somewhat, or the military doesn't really pose much of a threat to that person. And the political party that maybe even launched this person into power has become very, very weak, almost impotent. So we can make a big distinction between, let's say, communist China, which is run by a political party. And even though you have Xi Jinping as the leader, he has to contend with a lot more individuals, and there's more than one person actually making the decisions. And you can make that distinction between, let's say, when Saddam Hussein was ruling Iraq, and he was personally making all the decisions and sometimes making decisions in complete isolation.
Very interesting. So what we're seeing now, I think you and others suggest, is quite different to the 20th century dictators, the Idi Amins, I suppose the Saddams and the like. So what was that model and how was it different?
Well, in the past, dictatorships were more overtly brutal and more controlling in a way that was more obvious, almost completely controlling censorship, killing people, more in mass numbers, and not really trying to use democratic institutions and manipulate them. They were really overtly brutal and authoritarian. If we were to contrast that with today, the type of dictatorships are more subtle. And they do this through electoral engineering, messing with the electoral laws to their favor, gerrymandering, and more subtle techniques of controlling the media rather than completely censoring everything.
Yes, we read an interesting article by a colleague of yours, Erica Franz, describing a strategy that she posed was going to be much more of the 21st century model, by which the would-be dictator gains power, as you say, through democratic means, and then subtly and somewhat insidiously dismantles those very democratic institutions. Could you offer some examples as to where you think that has happened or happening?
Well, I think one of the best examples of this would be in Venezuela under Chavez. And so Hugo Chavez was a left-wing populist. There are many people that really loved him. And that's true of dictatorships. I think it would be wrong to assume that authoritarian leaders are not loved. They may have some higher levels of popularity than you would believe. That's actually genuine. But in the case of Chavez, he slowly started to erode at the institutions by creating like extra bodies that would make legislative decisions that he completely had control over, where he could appoint all the people in these bodies, and they were dependent on him, and so that way there was really no check on his power. By really attacking the judiciary, removing judges that ruled against him. But he could also really control the media in subtle ways, too. He could prevent some media outlet from getting a license. They could sort of threaten and harass the media that wasn't really supportive of him. And then also he could directly connect with the people through his like weekly chat shows that he would have, where he would basically had his own television show. And he would be able to use that as a platform to talk about himself in a positive way. That would have been unfair, really, to any kind of challenger that was trying to go against him in any kind of election.
You know, I don't know that you specifically go into this, but the politics of identity seem to have become more and more important as the world has globalised. And I wonder whether these personalist dictators tend to tap into people's great numbers of people's need to identify with their nation or their particular community. And I was thinking of Erdogan in Turkey, who seems to sort of know how to tap into the needs of a whole lot of people, for instance, in Anatolia, for a sense of solidarity, whereas the opponents don't seem to be quite as good at that.
Yeah, definitely. There were a lot of personalist dictatorships that maybe they came from, and I'm talking about maybe some examples in Africa. They might have come from a specific tribe or ethnic group, and they would definitely play up to that tribe and try to distribute patronage to that particular tribe. But what you're seeing with Erdogan is something that is a little bit different, because he's appealing to a larger segment of his population. And he is playing into people's fears of others, of the Kurds, and connecting with them, in particular those in coming from rural areas. And he's been really, really effective in the sense that he could probably win an election without tampering or, you know, engaging in massive fraud. He's popular. And he's able to connect with these voters on the exact thing that you're talking about, this politics of identity and the fears of what could happen if he's not in power, because he's the only one that's able to really protect them from all the threats that they face.
And who understands this need for identification. You also write that many dictators have little patience for learning about policy, which they find downright tedious.
Yeah, I think that's one of the differences between these personalistic types of leaders and those authoritarian regimes where it's run by a single party. And again, just to bring back to the example of China, or you could look at Vietnam or Singapore, you're going to have a lot of people that are actually technocrats in these parties. And they may have a lot of experience and know how to make policy. And as a result, the policy output is actually quite steady, and they may even be coming up with good ideas that lead to development. But with these personalistic types of leaders, they are so into attracting attention and their popularity, and they're sort of entranced by their own charisma, and they're not really technocrats, they're not really into policy. I mean, the classic case was Idi Amin, who used to have, you know, cabinet meetings by campfire, and he found cabinet meetings really boring, and he would drift off and want to talk about other things. They don't really like getting mired in the day-to-day activities of running a country. What they like is all the, you know, just personal glorification.
Sorry, I was just, I'll just let listeners know that we're talking to Natasha Esro from the University of Essex, talking about different versions of dictatorship. And of course, as we're listening to your description, we're thinking of a particular man in the White House. You've written for our online journal, The Conversation, with the provocative title, Is Trump a Dictator in the Making? Now, that was in November last year. 4 months later, what would you say?
Well, he's doing everything he can to really threaten the democratic institutions in the U.S. He doesn't seem to think that the judiciary is very important. He makes comments all the time about how, you know, the judges, or so-called judges he's referred to, aren't really doing their job very effectively. He seems very frustrated by the legislature and the fact that you have to actually work with a lot of individuals, and that they're going to sort of check on his power. But I think the biggest threat of Trump, which is really, really scary, is what he's doing with the media. And he's got a lot of things that he's doing that's very similar to Chavez in Venezuela. He is completely delegitimizing the media And not just sort of outlets that are not that well known or whatever. He takes something like CNN and he says, you're fake news. So that means that, and this is an incredibly important check on, on leaders in democracies, that the critics, anyone that tries to criticize him, he just says it's fake. And that means that if anybody hears news that is negative about him, they just don't believe it. And that becomes really difficult for voters to make accurate decisions if he is just completely delegitimizing the sources of information that might provide a check on his power.
Well, it requires a certain dogged involvement in the process by citizenry, doesn't it? Which is, well, I suppose I could ask you, what does your evidence suggest? How do citizens get past this or learn to see through it?
I think his hardcore supporters are never going to see through it. Right now, Trump's approval rating is really low. It's under 40%. And that does show that he hasn't connected with everybody. But it appears that those hardcore supporters that just think that he's, you know, the greatest thing and that he can really do no wrong, they really refuse to believe the media. And if you don't want to believe the truth, I mean, we've entered a really weird world in the U.S. where we have things called alternative facts. And, you can give someone a statistic about a crime rate and suddenly it's coming from our reputable sources and people just don't believe it. So, I mean, citizens have to want to seek the truth and have to want to believe in facts. And, I mean, the best example of this is he said that he had the most people watching the inauguration and photographic evidence proved otherwise. And yet there's still people that just don't want to believe it. So I think for citizens that really want to find the truth, they can find it. The media is working to check his power. But the worry is there seems to be a larger segment of the population than you would think that just don't believe the media, don't trust the media, and trust him even more than any kind of media sources.
So finally, Natasha, I mean, there are people who would say, look, this is not as prone to happen in developed democracies as opposed to, say, developing democracies like Poland and Hungary and, say, the Philippines, who have recent experience of totalitarianism. But in the developed democracies, how should they ideally respond then to these quite disturbing trends you're describing?
Well, I mean, this is kind of a long-term thing that they would need to do, is that we need to continue to improve our just civic education. I think most individuals in the U.S. don't really know that much about the Constitution and about how government works, and there just needs to be better information out there so that citizens just have just more of a clue about things. But that's sort of a long-term strategy. And, you know, all the different checks on the executive, we just have to, you know, hope that these can be maintained, such as the media, you know, not delegitimizing the media and understanding, you know, the media actually is supposed to criticize the president. And maybe, you know, presidents aren't going to like that, but that's just something that it's not unpatriotic to do so. It is actually very patriotic to be able to question authority in democracies. And, you know, we need to make sure that we're not delegitimizing the different checks on the executive.
The checks and balances. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I really appreciate your insights. Natasha Esrow, E-Z-R-O-W, if you're looking for any of her books. She's a senior lecturer of government at the University of Essex in England, the author of two books on dictatorships, the latest a monograph on the politics of dictatorship, if you care to seek that out.